From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the pages of the Democrat and Chronicle late last month. Rochester City Councilmember Mitch Gruber and University of Rochester History Professor Stuart Weaver had written an op-ed about what they described as the university's moral and civic obligations to our community. U of R is Rochester's largest employer, and it has made headlines in recent weeks for issues related to inequity when it comes, for example, to vaccine distribution. WXXI News reported in late January that the university offered major donors access to a COVID-19 vaccine clinic meant for employees. The special access was possible through URMC's executive health program. After widespread outrage from the community, UR students, and the Strong Hospital Ethics Committee, UR leadership decided to phase out that program. As noted by Gruber and Weaver in their op-ed, University of Rochester leadership stated the special vaccine access does not reflect the values of the institution. It also reinstated employee wages, salaries, and benefits, and announced a commitment to a $15 minimum wage. But is that enough? Gruber and Weaver argue that the university should be doing more to improve the welfare of the entire community. They point to institutions like Johns Hopkins University and the University of Pennsylvania, which have invested tens of millions of dollars into their communities. Rochester has felt the loss of Kodak and the impact, and, according to ACT Rochester, is ranked third in overall poverty among the nation's largest 75 metro areas. So this hour we ask the question, what responsibility do large employers have to their communities? We've invited the authors of the op-ed to join us. Mitch Gruber is a member of Rochester City Council. Mitch, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Stuart Weaver is a professor of history at the University of Rochester and president of the UR chapter of the American Association of University Professors. Stuart, welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Evan. Thanks for having us.
Let me ask both of you. I'll start with you, Mitch, just what you set out to accomplish with that op-ed. Go ahead.
Sure. Thanks. And I also just want to note that it's a privilege and a pleasure to be on the show with Stuart, who was my professor when I started my PhD program. I think I had him for a course my first semester, and it's an honor to be able to work with him now in a different space. So I guess to answer your question, Evan, and to just add on to what you said in your introduction to the show, it's not just about the U of R's role as the largest employer in town. It's also about the U of R's role as a nonprofit organization. And they're not doing anything against what is allowable, but I think there's some serious problems with the way that we structure nonprofit law and tax exemption across the country. And when you think about it, the University of Rochester is the biggest property holder in the city of Rochester. They do not pay property taxes. So this is not about them only as the biggest employer or them only as, you know, one thing or another. It is really a conversation, I think, about how do we build equity in a city when we have property holders as big as the University of Rochester who are not obligated to pay any type of property tax.
Okay. Stuart, do you want to add to that? Go ahead.
I think that's a fair summary, and I'll just return the thanks to Mitch. It's great to be working with Mitch in this new capacity as well. And I've been at the University of Rochester for a long time and have observed the evolution of its relationship with the city of Rochester over a long period of years. And so this speaks to my own longstanding concern about this issue of the university's commitment to its civic mission. But in particular, most recently, I'm speaking somewhat on behalf of a new chapter of the American Association of University Professors, which has taken shape, come into being on the university at the University of Rochester, largely in response to issues having to do with the COVID-19 pandemic. And the AAUP, among other things, takes a very great interest in the civic obligations of American institutions of higher education, and it's in that capacity that I'm contributing to this conversation as far as I can.
Okay. Well, Mitchell, I want to ask you about some of the defense. It's not necessarily defense. It's not like this is overly adversarial. I know that you and your colleagues have good relationships with the leadership from the U of R, and this is essentially an effort to kind of spur others to do more or better as you see it. But if there's a defense of institutions or even a company, say Wegmans, for example, the defense is their success is an act of goodwill to the community. They employ a lot of people. They employ people in different locations doing different work. They offer career paths for people who might not otherwise have it. And just their success alone is all they must do to justify what they're doing to the community because of their ability to employ, their ability to support families, et cetera. Do you disagree with that? I mean, take Wegmans, for example. The idea that Wegmans would have an obligation, for example, to open a store in parts of Rochester where they currently don't serve. The defenders of Wegmans would say they don't have to do that. They should operate wherever, you know, they see fit and wherever the return is for them. I mean, how do you sort of balance what you think is the obligation of an institution or a company, a big employer, to the community beyond just successful bottom line and employment as they see it?
I think that I would need to disentangle these two things. I think there's a conversation about, you know, Wegmans or Paychex or all of the major employers in town who have chosen to set up shop in the suburbs and pay suburban property taxes. And I'd be happy to have that conversation at some point. But I think right now, in particular, this is a moment to be talking about what it means for our nonprofit institutions who functionally operate as businesses. And I think that's true of private institutions across the country. Again, this is not specific to the U of R, but if you look at other nonprofit institutions who are certainly capitalizing off the fact that they don't have to pay property taxes, but functionally operate as a private business, then you start to think about how does a city as poor as Rochester begin to make progress in terms of our budget deficit every year. You know, the city of Rochester starts with a $30 million budget deficit every year at minimum. How do we start to think about that when our biggest property holders in the city are classified as nonprofits but function as for-profits? And so I think it's particularly interesting now because of two things, if you don't mind me expounding on that.
Sure.
One is that we just went through a really, really difficult year as a community. And the University of Rochester was very public and firm in saying that they were not going to touch their endowment. And they didn't touch their endowment. And they said that their endowment, which is in the Stuart may have a better answer than me, or I can look it up while we're on the call here, but it's an endowment that is way bigger than I think any of us could potentially imagine in terms of trying to think about those dollar amounts. For example,
a couple billion dollars, I think.
Yeah, the city of Rochester's operating budget annually is $550 million. The U of R's endowment is triple, quadruple that. So they didn't touch it. And when Stuart and I were writing this op-ed collectively, one of the words that that he used shows you why he's a professor and I'm not, is that the university fetishizes their endowment. And I think that's a really important thing to think about. Here we are in the exact definition, I think, of what a rainy day is when it comes to having a rainy day fund, and they're not touching it. Meanwhile, what really prompted this whole op-ed and this whole conversation for me and really a goal of mine is to make some significant progress on this in the next couple of years is actually a series of articles that was sent to me by a friend and a former employee of the city of Rochester who was sharing me a bunch of articles from the city of Philadelphia about how faculty, students, and community members were starting to push for the University of Pennsylvania, whose endowment is significantly bigger than the University of Rochester's, to begin to pay a pilot, a.k.a. a payment in lieu of taxes for your listeners out there.
Yeah.
And it made a significant amount of progress, so much so that it feels to me like the university preempted the idea of having to pay a pilot and actually went out and said they were committing $100 million, $10 million for 10 years, specifically to address asbestos remediation in the Philadelphia Central School District. That's $100 million going from a private university that had no real obligation to pay that money going into an under-resourced school district. This is the time that this is happening in other institutions. We just watched the university say that they're not touching their endowment, even though the needs in this community were immense. They made employees, frankly, suffer during, I think they did their best, don't get me wrong. They did their best without touching the endowment, I should say. But that's part of the reason why there is an AAUP chapter now, which Stuart can talk about. this is not a conversation about Wegmans or paychecks. This is a conversation about the University of Rochester.
Okay, and so let me just follow up with you, and then I'll turn to Professor Weaver for this. But on the subject of endowments, Mitch. So Rochester's University of Rochester's endowment is $2.6 billion, give or take, you know, $100 million or so. You know, Harvard's endowment's $41 billion. Princeton's endowment is $26 billion. Just throw, I mean, Stanford is probably in between those. It's a lot of money. Now, we've talked endowments on this program in the past. One of the things I have come to believe about endowments is that universities do a horrible job of explaining it to the public about what they are and what their function is. And sometimes they complain that the public doesn't get it. The public doesn't understand that it's not just a big bank account. It's not like U of R has $2.6 billion just to do whatever they want, and they're just choosing not to offer financial help for students who can't otherwise pay, or they're just choosing not to raise wages. And so about a year ago, the pandemic hits, and there was talk. I mean, the president of Brown University said that if we don't make sure that students can be back on campus in the fall, then we could see institutions across the country literally close. This could threaten our existence. And you know what people were saying? They were saying, well, you've got endowments. This is the time to use them as the rainy day fund, as you say, Mitch. Now, when we talked about it on this program, I'm going to do my best to sum up what I was told, which is that I said, look, yes, I understand that in your endowment, somebody said, yeah, here's money for an athletic facility, or here's money for a science lab. Here's money for research. Technically, the university feels beholden to the money that's earmarked in that way, and they don't feel like they can just use it however they want. But this is an emergency. So I said, why not call that donor and say, look, I know you gave money for this endowment for a sports field or for a science lab, but we are in dire straits. We've got a pandemic. People are dying, and we could close. We need the green light to use it as we see fit. And they said, if we did that, we would offend people who gave the money. I couldn't believe what I heard, but that's what I was told, and they were basically told our hands are tied on this money. It's not just a bank account. You can't just use it how you want. Do you think people like me, people like you, Mitch, people like the public, just misunderstand what endowments are?
No, I don't think that. I think that I'm certain that universities, like anyone else, like any other nonprofit entities, are correct in identifying some restricted dollars. That's not to say that the entire $2.6 billion can just be used in any way. I believe that there are things that are restricted. I also believe that there is probably some things that are claimed to be restricted that are not. But I'll tell you what I think would solve that, some real significant transparency around this, and some identification of how endowment dollars are spent, why they're spent that way, and what kind of flexibility there is. And I don't think that's just true of the U of R. I just looked it up, by the way. They have the 28th largest endowment in the country. It is significantly smaller than the ones that you mentioned, Evan, but it's nothing to sneeze at.
No, no.
And so, you know, I think that transparency would be nice. This is not something that I think requires folks to say, or allows folks to just say, well, the money is restricted. Okay, that's the end of the conversation. Again, we have a city, we have a city school district, we have a lot of functions that are regularly asking for additional resources to function appropriately. And then we have an institution that's sitting on $2.6 billion. And by the way, if I'm going to take it one step further, which I will, I'll also say that right after the right after they kind of announced all these moves in terms of the $15 minimum wage, in terms of the end of the, you know, executive vaccine program, they also announced the groundbreaking of the largest capital project in their history, which is this new orthopedic center in Marketplace Mall. So, you know, now granted, they started that well before the pandemic. I understand that. But let's think about the optics here. We have a city that's struggling. We had a university just tell us they're not going to touch their endowment. And then when push comes to shove, here we are a year still in the pandemic, and they're breaking ground on a multi-hundred-million-dollar. Is that right? Maybe I don't have the number. Don't quote me on that. But their biggest capital project of all time in Marketplace Mall in the suburbs. So, you know, there's. The conversation is not just as simple as it's restricted, that's the end of the story. Let's have some transparency on this.
Okay, but are you saying that they have more flexibility with the endowment than they have let on?
Until they prove otherwise, yes.
Okay, Stuart Weaver, can you add to that?
Well, we just want to hold open the possibility that that's true. Yes, as Mitch says, I think the faculty generally, well, I can't speak for the entire U of R faculty, so speaking for myself, I suppose, and other members of our chapter whom I've spoken to, we understand that there are limits on what the university can do in the endowment. We understand that certain restrictions surround it. And we also understand the frequently reiterated need to preserve the endowment for the future, that the future of the institution rests on the health and sustainable growth of the endowment and all those things. We don't dispute any of that. But we agree emphatically with Mitch, and he's not the only alumnus of the institution who believes this, by the way. The alumni community generally, in some respects, that there should be more transparency around the question of the endowment. A certain amount of obscurity surrounds it beyond the raw figures of what it's worth. And also, what moved Mitch and I to write the op-ed, the so-called Special Payment Services Vaccine Clinic, which was quickly shut down, and as you noted, the U of R ended its executive health program and insisted that this service for vaccine service for donors had been in some respects inadvertent, and we accept all of that also. But it did speak to a larger issue, which Mitch is alluding to, which is the tendency of the university, and not just the University of Rochester, but all of those who have large endowments like ours, to conceive of its institutional mission almost in terms of its endowment performance, to the extent where keeping an eye on the endowment and making sure we nurture it and grow it and all those things begins to displace other institutional imperatives, and in particular the one we're talking about is the civic imperative to invest substantially in Rochester.
All right. What I want to do is answer some questions from listeners on these subjects with Mitch Gruber, member of Rochester City Council, and Professor Stuart Weaver, professor of history at the University of Rochester and president of the UR chapter of the American Association of University Professors, critical in a way that they hope spurs the University of Rochester to move in the direction of fulfilling more of what they think its mission should be to our community. And frankly, its responsibility to the community. David calling from California first. Go ahead, David.
Oh, morning. Thanks. Or I guess afternoon for you, right?
It is, yes, indeed.
The issue of doing public good is since 1776, America's basis for handing out business licenses or nonprofit status was that the person requesting it had to provide public good. Because otherwise it was going to go straight back into the old colony economics and that the hard work of a region would be sucked out of town and possibly even out of the nation. So the idea that I appreciate this topic, and it's funny, I wasn't aware of the endowment issue, but I'm just wondering, since you're both from New York, Donald Trump, this crisis of last year was from New York, and he has been hooked up with all sorts of financial con artists for years, and ripping apart an endowment while the nation is going through an intentional mismanagement of an epidemic. I'm just wondering whether there were some board members who might have said, no, please don't rip apart the endowment. He's gonna even make it worse. And we didn't know that he would lose the election until a month or two ago. So it's I'm just wondering if there is possibly a saving grace aspect to this where the money managers, the financial managers in the endowment were playing their cards as close to the vest as possible because they didn't want the endowment assets to be ripped apart.
Yeah, David, I appreciate the phone call, and good morning to our listeners on the West Coast. David, I would just say, before I turn it over to Professor Weaver and to Councilman Gruber on this, number one, us being from New York and Donald Trump being from New York, it's a long way away, sir. We're about 5 hours by car. We're more Canadian than New York City right now. But I understand what you're saying, that the Trump administration rattled a lot of sabers about higher ed endowments, and was there a move to protect it? The only reason, Professor Weaver, I would be skeptical of that is that what the University of Rochester has done in the last year regarding its endowment is what it has always done. This is not a new set of behaviors with regard to the endowment. Do you agree?
Absolutely. I think that's right. As I say, I've been here a long time, and I remember previous discussions about the rate at which the endowment could be spent down, the percentage points this way and that way. With a sum of money this large, a certain percentage point, a small percentage point, can make a big difference to an endowment draw and coming up with the kinds of sums that a pilot, a payment in lieu of taxes, might require. I should say that everything I know about pilots I've learned only recently from Mitch, but I have noticed in reading about it since that this idea that private institutions such as ours that have a non-profit status and a property tax exempt status, the idea that they should make some sort of payment to the cities in which they reside is gaining traction nationally. And we mentioned in our op-ed the examples of Penn and Johns Hopkins University, both to some extent peer institutions, comparable institutions to ours, but there are many, many others that have now stepped up and agreed either to pay a full pilot, full payment in lieu of taxes based on what the property tax evaluation and assessment would be, but many more who have agreed simply to pay a proportion of that sum as a standing stable commitment to the often impoverished cities in which they sit. We don't dispute for a moment, I should say, that the U of R has a good sense of civic citizenship, and we could talk a lot more about the great strides, as we mentioned in our op-ed, about the great strides that the U of R has made, particularly recently, I think, under the new administration of President Sarah Mangelsdorf, toward shared governance and toward a civic commitment in certain respects, in particular by way of the $15 minimum wage, as we mentioned in our op-ed. And there are a lot of things going on campus by way of the Center for Community Engagement, the commitment to East High and the Golisano Children's Hospital, all kinds of institutes like the Susan B. Anthony Center, the Frederick Douglass Institute, the Humanities Center, many more that are very committed to community engagement, as the very name of the Center for Community Engagement suggests. But often these are discretionary investments. They come here, they come there. There's an effort on the part of one of these institutes to do what it can by way of connecting faculty and staff and students to the community, to there and the community's mutual advantage. But what a pilot is all about, as I understand it, and Mitch knows more about them than I do, is a stable, standing commitment in lieu of a property tax that would be reliable and dependable, and the Rochester City School District in particular might be able to count on year in and year out to address that kind of deficit that that Mitch talked about in the opening. And we just believe that there is a percentage point or two in the endowment that might contribute toward at least something like that, a gesture toward a payment in lieu of taxes.
Okay, and Councilman Gruber, I'll let you follow up on that. Let me also say that we're going to invite the University of Rochester leadership on to at least give us more insight on the use of the endowment, because I know I'm going to be told that we just don't really get it, and I do want them to try to explain better to the community, and I don't say that in any snarky fashion. I think these conversations are happening across the country where institutions have large endowments. So we will reopen that door, but I do hope our guests on the program now will perhaps listen along or maybe join that conversation to at least follow up, because I think it would be beneficial for everybody to have that conversation. Councilman Gruber, go ahead. I'd like to, if you could, to follow the professor's remarks there.
Sure, and please call me Mitch. Appreciate it. First of all, I would love to listen. I'd love to participate in any way. It doesn't have to be on the show. It could be afterwards with university leadership on this conversation. What I want to make clear is I want to echo Stewart's comments about the fact that we're not trying to ignore the sense of citizenship that the U of R has already made it clear that they do feel. This is mostly to say we're in a new era. I think we have to think differently about the relationship between the college and the university now, or sorry, the university and the town and the city than we've done in the past. But the point that I really want to make, and this is the most important one that I hope anyone from university leadership who is listening acknowledges, that this is ultimately something that should be mutually beneficial. And, you know, I would not propose the idea of the U of R paying a pilot or some version of a pilot. And there's multiple ways to do it that are less formal than a pilot. I wouldn't argue for them to pay it to go into kind of general operating funds of any one bigger governmental institution, because I don't think there's easy ways to see the mutual benefit there. But I'm just going to give one example. I've been talking about this one a lot, as I'm sure a lot of other people in the community have, and that's digital divide. You know, to break down the digital divide is going to require some significant investment. And I wholeheartedly believe that investment needs to come from a multitude of places. It should come from state government, from federal government, from local government. It should also come, I believe, from the business community. It should also come from the University of Rochester. And what I would argue is that if, in fact, we're able to break down the digital divide, and even doing that is complicated, but let's say we get there, that offers huge advantages to the university as well. There's dollars to be saved on their end through improved telehealth. There's dollars to be gained there by having a more technologically plugged in and connected community. That's just one example of a way that if we actually found the investment, and if the university and others invested in something like this, we would see everybody benefit. So this is not just about taxing the U of R and then putting it into an operating fund to be able to do something that no one can detect. I think there's ways to do this just like Penn did, where they took $100 million and they went in and they are working on fixing some really significant asbestos problems in the Philadelphia Central School District. So we can be deliberate, we can be specific, and it can be mutually beneficial.
All right, let me get back to your phone calls. This is Lois Louise. I'm in between here. Is it Lois or Louise?
Louise.
Hi, Louise. Thank you.
Hi. Thank you so much. So I hope my call is pertinent to what is happening here. Your guest's opening statement about how much Strong and U of R owns property here in Rochester is so correct and beyond what people have any idea. And the way that this current administration under Mayor Lovely Warren makes up the difference for this non-for-profit property is she does very unfair reassessments to residential property owners. And then it's not even hypothetical. If you have a house that was built in 1880 and it's really worth $40,000, she is going to kick that up, $40,000-$50,000, and then she gets the taxes on that hike up of that home. That's how her and Loretta Scott get to say, oh, we don't raise property taxes. You do. You just do it through the back door of these unfair reassessments that you keep doing to homeowners here in the South Wedge area, the 19th Ward. Also, U of R is paying 10% for any of their full-time professional workers to buy a home in the 19th Ward and South Wedge. They're paying their first 10% on the mortgage. So they not only will have all the property, but then they have their workers in those properties as well. And also, quite honestly, our prime downtown area, we've got Jiva and we've got St. Mary's Church that never pays a dime in taxes, but their patrons drive in from Brighton and Pittsburgh, and they have the seat at the table to say, we don't want any urban, wildlife in and around our property. So this has been going on for years, but under Lovely Warren, it's been the worst. And she did another one in 2020, right in the middle of COVID, when people were really, hard hit. Even Pittsburgh and Penfield stopped their home reassessment, saying this would be cruel to do it now. She does it to commercial property as well. So then the landlords have to raise the rent on little stores and, you know, things, and then those properties go out. But that's how it happens here. They get it through our, through the homeowners, and give tons of land to non-for-profit. So this show's fantastic. And the other thing I want to say, one last thing, the man who called from California, they don't call this show Connections for nothing. That's amazing.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Louise. I appreciate that. Yeah, we get calls from Vancouver sometimes, New Mexico. No, it's really lovely. A lot of Rochester expats, and sometimes we bump into listeners who say they found us for one reason or another and stayed with us. So it's great. We appreciate that. Mitch Gruber, you want to respond to some of what she said about how money is raised and how taxes are raised?
Sure. I mean, I would argue with the correlation there. I think we're talking about two different things. Certainly, there was a reassessment that took place in 2020. I definitely heard from a lot of constituents, a lot of concerns and complaints about that. But I would also say that I think that the city's assessor and assessment office did a very good job of being able to hear concerns and complaints and talk through things. But reassessments are simply they are a part of life as a homeowner. That's just a true statement. But I think it, again, diverges from the point, which is that the University of Rochester, I don't think reassessments happen and get raised because of the U of R, but I think there's an argument to be said that if you calculate the amount of land that the university owns and doesn't pay taxes on, that it's possible that tax rates and assessments might all be able to go down if that was a different story. I do want to just touch on one other thing that she said, if you don't mind, Evan. Which is there was a mention of Geneva and St. Mary's. I think this gets into a really interesting point, right? Like, what is the purpose of a nonprofit? What is the purpose of tax exemption? And as you know, and as a lot of your listeners who know me know, I also work for a nonprofit organization and have for 13 years now, that is Foodlink. And Foodlink functions wholly as a charity. That is how we operate. Geneva, I think, is an organization that I know and love very well, and I don't believe for a moment that they've ever acted as a for-profit business before. I think the religious institutions is another really interesting and separate conversation, but the point isn't just about nonprofits blanket. It is about private universities, but I would go even further and more specific, private universities with hospitals that act as businesses. They function as private businesses. That is the way that they are geared. That is what's in their DNA. And those are the institutions that I think across the country we really need to take a look at and make sure that they are contributing to the wellness of their communities.
Okay. Professor Weaver, do you want to add to that?
Well, I would only add one small point to that. Mitch just said in those universities who ought to be looking at this issue of pilots in particular are those that have this relationship with a medical center such as ours, URMC. And I would just add to that that there has been a lot of discussion lately on the River campus and elsewhere in the university about that relationship. And it's a very technical and difficult one, but there's an increasing conversation going on in the Faculty Senate elsewhere raised by COVID about that relationship and the sort of financial relationship between the two and who works like a business, as Mitch has been putting it, within the university, and who doesn't. And to have that conversation can start to shed some sort of light on the financial workings of the endowment and whom it supports and who it doesn't, and who should be tax exempt and who shouldn't, maybe.
Robert in Fairport, Kathy in Chilai, we'll take your comments after this only break of the hour. Our guests are talking about the University of Rochester's moral and civic obligations. Mitch Gruber is a member of Rochester City Council and a UR alum, PhD in history from the University of Rochester. I'm not sure I even knew that. Shouldn't be surprised. Stuart Weaver is a professor of history at the University of Rochester, president of the UR chapter of the American Association of University Professors. They are our guests, and they co-authored the op-ed in the DNC about the university's moral and civic obligations. More of your feedback on the other side of this break. This is Connections. Robert in Fairport next on the phone. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for the thanks for taking my call. This discussion is long overdue, and other schools have had similar discussions. Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, had a discussion because Providence basically went bankrupt, somewhere a few years ago and whatnot, and, you know, Brown wasn't paying anything for that. But I think that these deals where the nonprofits don't pay anything in property taxes lead to some real distortions. I mean, they're not all in the city either. I mean, if you look at Pittsburgh, if you go up and look at the new YMCA in Pittsburgh, that was a $40 million building that ironically houses a U of R Medical Center office in the basement. And, you know, there's nobody paying any property taxes for that at 3% a year. That's about $120,000 a year in property taxes they should be paying. And the question is, does the university and do these nonprofits use public services? And what should they pay for them? If you look at the U of R, tax dollars, I think it was like 50 to 70 million in tax dollars went to create an exit on, I think it was 490 for one of their offices. I mean, it's incredible.
Robert, thank you. Mitch Gruber, member of Rochester City Council. What do you think?
Yeah, I think he hit it on the head. The issue here is that I think what we really need, I mean, the best solution for this ultimately would be a complete reassessment and overhaul of the IRS tax code and these tax laws at a national level. I'm not going to hold my breath and wait for that to happen, which is why I really like what Penn did recently with Philadelphia, which I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. That's kind of been the model for a lot of this. And by the way, there's, for anyone listening who's interested, there's a great website. It's just Penn for Pilots. I believe the 4 is actually the number 4, but if not, Evan, I can share it with you afterwards if you want to post it. But okay, the folks from Penn put a ton of time and effort, and by the way, it was led predominantly by a bunch of leftist historians, which, as Stuart knows, that's always the way that it starts in a university. So I'm really hopeful that we can take some lessons from that and not sit back and wait for national laws around tax code to change, but really think about what can we do immediately and what can we do that has some real collective mutual benefit. I don't think that it's impossible to imagine us getting there sooner rather than later, and I can assure you that that's going to be one of the things that I'm laser focused on in the next couple of years.
And Mitch, separate question, but since it came up, the YMCA of Greater Rochester has looked at potentially permanently closing or scaling back some of its city operations, while, as Robert points out, opening just before the pandemic its mega million-dollar facility in Pittsburgh. Of course, the one in Penfield is pretty glitzy. And I want to ask if you have any problem with that, or if you think that is just the way it has to be run.
No, I don't think it is the way it has to be run. But I also have a lot of respect for the YMCA's leadership and vision on a lot of things over the years, and I don't want to speak on their behalf. I would hope very much that they would not do that. I've heard the same rumors that you just mentioned. I'm not going to assume anything until I hear it from them themselves. But I will say this much: when it comes to whatever happened with the town of Pittsburgh or the village, I always mix it up, town or village,
town, yeah,
and their approval through the whole process of letting the Y take that land. They knew very well when this happened 4 or 5 years ago, the town I'm talking, they knew that they were not going to ever get taxes from this property. I think what's different is that the University of Rochester has been in operation for so long, I mean, well over 100 years, 100 and I don't know, Stuart, 120, 130 years.
1850 is our founding.
Oh,
so.
Good Lord. Don't tell anyone that I have a PhD in history from the U of R. I should have known that.
But so a very, very long time. And obviously the realities of the city never being able to get a dollar of property taxes from those properties that were built 100, you know, some odd years ago is a lot more problematic than the village of Pittsford approving something 4 or 5 years ago. And again, that doesn't mean that the tax laws themselves aren't broken, but there is a major difference there. And the city of Rochester is in some ways handcuffed by the U of R owning all this property and not paying property taxes. And then, mind you, when they're going to create something like the Orthopedic Center, instead of finding a way to create jobs and create some vibrancy in the city, they choose Marketplace Mall. And I think that's a larger part of the conversation here.
Okay. Let me read an email from a listener named Kathy. And as I read this, let me just also direct listeners to part of the op-ed written by our guests for the Democrat and Chronicle, in which they write, quote, "The UR can build off its recent announcements to chart a path towards better corporate citizenship. It can address unfair labor practices too common in higher education." I'll ask them to explain that after I read Kathy's email, which touches on some of the issues she has. She writes, "The University of Rochester is getting rid of URMC, getting rid of patient care technicians, mostly through attrition, which require minimal training but are union positions, and they are hiring LPNs instead, which is not as helpful in reality as it seems on paper. This decreases the number of jobs open to the community that don't require several years of post-high school education. They occasionally fire people for, quote, being late, when those persons do not have any other job history problem. Often these people have to take two buses to get to work. They could work with mass transit to create better transportation to the university. The university puts 6% into a retirement account annually for people making up to about $75,000 per year. Not a match, it's free money. For people that make more than $75,000 per year, the university puts 10% into their retirement account. That could be reversed. People that make poverty wages don't have extra money to put in their own retirement accounts. People that make over $75,000 can afford to put away some of their money tax-free. That would help with the wealth gap." So those are all things that Kathy brings up. She does ask as well, just curious, is there any comparison to what RIT, even though they're not located in Rochester proper, gives back to the community? I feel that I occasionally hear that they do partner with different community groups. Kathy, I don't know if there's an easy way to compare RIT to U of R here, but I'll ask both of our guests. And Professor Weaver, what do you make of Kathy pointing out some of the concerns she sees with employees who make different amounts of money, the opportunity they get to have retirement contributions, what she thinks is sort of a stringent look at employees who just want to be able to get to work, but they don't own cars? I mean, what do you make of all that?
Well, I don't know if this is also what you were alluding to, Evan, when you said you wanted to come back to our bit in our op-ed about unfair labor practices too common in higher education. It seems a related question. And it takes us somewhat away from the whole question of pilots and the university endowment and the property tax exemption and all that stuff. But the American Association of University Professors is interested in all these things, too. Its mission more broadly has to do with, defense of academic freedom, shared governance, upholding fundamental professional educational values, but also the economic security and the job security of those who work in institutions of higher education. And it works toward ensuring higher education's contribution to the common good in communities like ours, which is why at Penn, for instance, the Penn chapter of AAUP has taken a very strong supportive interest in the Penn for Pilots initiative. So the AAUP concerns itself with a lot of things, but certainly the economic security, fair labor practices, wage and salary equity, job contract security, these are the things that the AAUP is explicitly concerned with and devoted to securing. So it's part of the larger conversation about what Mitch is calling good corporate citizenship, and he can elaborate on what he means by that phrase, but it has an outward-looking face, good corporate citizenship or institutional citizenship. It has an outward-looking face toward the community, the city of Rochester, making this truly the city of Rochester, not just the University of Rochester, not a university in Rochester. But it also raises all the internal issues to the university itself about wage and salary equity, benefits. COVID exposed a lot of insecurity and worry and vulnerability around all of these issues. Unfortunately, the U of R has weathered COVID better than a lot of other colleges and universities out there. Ithaca College down the road has just laid off 100 faculty members. We've been spared this, but the AAUP keeps a very close eye on these things, particularly in the context of COVID.
All right, Mitch Gruber, do you want to add to that?
I'm sure it'll come as a surprise to Stuart, but I actually have nothing to add. I think he hit it on the head.
Okay. Tim writes to say, Evan, I hate to be the skunk at the picnic, but I question a lot of what your guests are presenting. Rochester's problems did not originate with the University of Rochester, and it's not their responsibility to fix it. The city has been in decline for 40 years, much of it thanks to white flight to the suburbs. We live in a racially divided community when it comes to education. The endowment is designed to think strategically, long-term, to help, as Joel Seligman once put it, to attract research into STEM. The UR aims to be at least a second-tier research facility. Money doesn't go to history or philosophy. The UR employees from within this region, now just imagine where we would be without them. You think we're poor now? That's from Tim. Mitch Gruber, what would you say to that?
Oh, so many things. I don't believe for a moment that just because the university didn't create the problem doesn't mean that they are not responsible for helping to solve it. The reality is there is no University of Rochester without Rochester. We need to not think of this as adversarial. I will continue to beat the drum of mutual benefit here, but I'm also going to go back and to a not so distant history and talk for a second about College Town. Here we have, and I wish I pulled it up in front of me, but College Town brought in a ton of public dollars. The city allocated a ton of public dollars with the goal of ultimately being able to contribute to our city in so many different ways. And let's look at College Town now. Let's look at Constantino's, the grocer that was supposed to come into all this fanfare, which is now functioning as a tax-exempt administrative office for the University of Rochester. These things happen all the time. So it doesn't matter that the university didn't create the problems that have beset this city and so many other cities in the United States of America over the last 150 years, just like Johns Hopkins didn't create the problems in Baltimore and Penn didn't create the problems in Philly. But it is a good corporate citizen's responsibility to be part of the solution. And there are really simple ways that we can align this and create this where there is mutual benefit. And that is my intention.
Professor Weaver, what do you want to add to that?
Maybe, Evan, just a little bit of historical perspective, mm-hmm. which is what I do after all. Our hope here, as we said in our op-ed, is to encourage the good steps the university is taking toward better corporate citizenship and also to recall the university to a traditional sense of its civic mission. The way the most recent caller described what the university is here to do, attract top international STEM scientists and support the global research mission of the institution, that's all true. And we don't mean to minimize the importance of that, but we would like to recall the U of R to a more traditional sense of the civic mission. At our founding in 1850, as I mentioned a moment ago, universities like ours were expressions of local pride. And the benefactors like George Eastman, who endowed them, saw them as expressions of local pride and were very committed to the communities in which they were established. They were meant to put a gloss, a sheen. They were meant to bring renown to the communities in which they were founded. And over time, increasingly, the tendency has been to look farther and farther outward, to peer institutions, to national and international reputation, to the endowment competition among other private universities, and the sense of local civic responsibility that original philanthropic donors like Eastman had has become attenuated. As I said before, to be the University of Rochester truly, you have to have an explicit commitment to the city of Rochester and not just sit in it tax exempt.
Okay, and so in our last minute here, I don't even have time to get all the calls and emails we got on this. There's a lot of buzz over the op-ed and this conversation. So, Mitch and Stuart, I do hope that you'd be willing to come back if the leadership of the university will come back on this program to address some of this, I hope in a constructive and productive way. But Mitch Gruber, in our last 30 seconds or so, what does it start to look like to signal to you that, yes, they've got the message and progress is being made in the direction you want to see it? What do those steps look like now?
Well, I think first there's some work to do still. I'm glad Stuart allowed me to present this to the AUP. I think there's work in getting the faculty to feel a certain way about this, the students for sure, and community. And I hope that the university leadership is listening to this, and I hope there's conversations to be had. But my prerogative right now, my goal right now, I should say, is to build increased energy and interest in this subject and eventually have something to bring to university leadership to talk about.
I appreciate the time, and I hope that this is the start of more of a productive conversation that will grow out of this. Mitch Gruber is a member of Rochester City Council. I know you feel the same way, Mitch. Let's do this again. Thank you.
Thank you.
Stuart Weaver, professor of history at the University of Rochester, president of the UR chapter of the American Association of University Professors. Professor Weaver, great having you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much for having us, Evan.
And our thanks to the producer of Connections, Megan Mack, the engineer, Rob Braden. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a nice afternoon, and we will be back with you, I should say, that is tomorrow, on member-supported public radio.